You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's Corner House podcast. I'm Dave Petty, the AV technician here at Corner House. This week, we review the new Lynn Ramsey film, We Need to Talk About Kevin, starring Tilda Swinton. We hear from Kit Abramson, the artist behind When Unlikely Things Happen, a unique one-off installation of musical metronomy that happened here last week as part of our micro-commission scheme. And we give you a taster of things to do this week in our mini What's On guide, and not forgetting, of course, our staff recommendation. So let's get straight to the heart of the matter with We Need to Talk About Kevin. I'm joined by programme manager Rachel Hayward and front of house manager Marshall Trower. Rachel, you saw this film at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Can you tell us a little bit more about the film?
Yeah, certainly. It was one of the top films in the competition lineup. And the film, as I'm sure many people will know, is an adaptation of Lionel Shriver's novel of the same name. And the film focuses entirely on Eva. Eva's the mother of the aforementioned Kevin. And he is, by all accounts, a monstrous child. Kevin and his mother, Eva, struggle with the mother-son relationship throughout the course of the film and throughout Kevin's childhood and teenage years. And then when he hits 15, or to be more accurate, just before his 16th birthday, his teenage rebellion goes way too far. And his mother's left to pick up the pieces and to cope with life in the town afterwards.
I think it's safe to say that what happens is pretty shocking. We don't want to give too much away, but Marshall, what did you think of the film?
First off, I thought it was an amazing film, and I'm certainly interested in reading the book after seeing that. I thought Lynn Ramsey's really done a credit to herself with this film. Just off the ideas of the son being a very negative character, I think what's interesting with Lynn Ramsey's adaptation is you can view it in sort of two lights. There's the one light where I don't necessarily agree with, where Kevin's this sort of omen-esque evil child who just from birth is like the worst son you can possibly imagine, who's just making Eva's life hell. Or there's another interpretation, which I'm leaning more towards, where you can interpret Eva as effectively a reluctant bad mother who, through her sort of emotional neglect, has created this son who effectively becomes a sociopath. But there, it's both open for interpretation. You can go either way.
I mean, the way I watched the film, without reading kind of too much into it, it felt very much, and this is in no way a slant on the film, I thought it was fantastic, it very much feels like a high concept film in that there's not too much, well, very little, if any at all, any context for why her son is the way he is. It felt to me very much like a blockbuster wrapped in an art house shell. Even the last line of the film, I'm not going to give anything away, but it almost felt like something kind of snatched from the latest Transformers film. It does have a very Hollywood tinge to it, but at the same time, it's absolutely furiously entertaining, despite this kind of slender plot that drives it forward. The performances are excellent, Tilda Swinton's fantastic, and John C. Reilly as well, who you wouldn't normally expect to see in this kind of film. He's very much a kind of a background role, but fits his character perfectly.
I do think, obviously this is a different interpretation, but I do think there are reasons for Kevin's behaviour, and I think they are there to be interpreted, but I think there's a very subtle notes to the film, and it's all very underplayed. A straight up note, there's very little dialogue, or there's very few between characters. It's more sort of Lynn Ramsey and Seamus McGreevy, I probably pronounced his name wrong, the cinematographer. It's more how they're just sort of presenting pieces of information to you. Like Tilda Swinton's character Eva is a sort of travel writer or some sort of adventure writer, and the film opens with her at, I believe, is it the Tomato Festival in Barcelona, where everyone's throwing the tomatoes at each other and having a great time. It opens up with her basically in bliss and having this sort of Christ-like episode where she's laid out as a cross, having this great time. And then sort of motherhood sort of gradually tames all her aspirations and things she wants to do. So I do think if you look closely enough, there are elements of sort of neglect or how her persona, which you actually see a little of because the film is from her perspective, rubs off onto her son Kevin. But on that, Tilda Swinton does do a fantastic job, and she's really perfect at playing this sort of destroyed husk of a woman who sort of shuffles around supermarkets and law courts and whatnot. I sort of be as bold as to say that the hugely traumatic event that I won't give away isn't the central part of the film. The film more deals with Eva's character dealing with the trauma of what she sees, which is actually depicted incredibly skillfully, again by the cinematography, repetition of the colour red, but also Joe Binney, whatever his name is, his use of editing where he overlaps there's a specific sound of sprinklers, again I won't give anything away, and again that's sort of relaying this trauma for Eva. So it's not so much the central event but more how she deals with it, but also the potential relationship she has with her son that could have created this. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on beside this hugely traumatic experience that happens.
You mentioned the cinematographer earlier. I mean, it does very much feel like a Lynn Ramsey film. When I was watching it, I was automatically comparing it to other filmmakers like Paul Thomas Anderson and Gus Van Sant. But as I was thinking of that, I thought, no, in fact, this is very much Lynn Ramsey's film, and it is very unique, and it has very much her stamp on it. Not, you know, not just the cinematography, but the film as a whole is incredibly individual. Rachel, for people who are maybe a bit hesitant to watch the adaptation, because you've read the book, how do you think it compares to the novel?
I think that the team behind the film have done an amazing job in adapting what is actually a really, really long, very, very dense novel. As a bit of an aside, I think that you should always both watch the film and read the novel, not try and kind of conflate the two into one. Always keep them separate. But in terms of this particular adaptation, they do actually, out of necessity, have to cut out a lot of the backstory, a lot of the information about family, about the family history that Eva herself is kind of trying to reconcile. So that might kind of answer some of your questions about needing some reasoning for why Kevin is like he is. Structurally, the novel's incredibly different because it's based on a series of letters that Eva's writing, whereas in the film, obviously, structuring around letters would not work. But instead, it translates rather into having Tilda Swinton on screen pretty much all the time, I think, as I recall. So if people have read the book and are a little bit hesitant, I would most definitely recommend it. It is a different experience, as you'd expect, but having read the novel, it does add to the film, I think.
So we need to talk about Kevin, previewing tonight at 8 p.m. right here at Corner House, and it'll continue to screen for at least 2 weeks from Friday, the 21st of October. As always, the trailer and all the times are on our website. Just visit cornerhouse.org/film.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Corner House, Manchester.
Okay, now it's time to have a look at what's going on this week. Our Asia Triennial Manchester film programme continues, and I'd like to highlight Brillante Mendoza's 2005 debut film, The Masseur, which is showing this Sunday, 23rd of October, at 4:30 p.m. Andy Willis, one of the co-curators of the film programme, caught up with Brillante when he visited Corner House last month.
Okay, and we've got Brillante Mendoza to tell us a little bit about his debut feature film. He'd been a very successful production designer for advertising and for films, and he moved into film directing with The Masseur in 2005. Brillante, can you tell us a little bit about The Masseur?
Yeah, The Masseur was shot in 2005, my first feature, and this is the story of a young boy, a teenager, who works in a brothel house and who has to attend to his father's funeral. So he has to go back to the province and attend to this funeral. And what happened next is a revelation of their relationship and his relationship with his family.
And one of the things that's quite striking about The Masseur is you use new technology in terms of camera and things like that, don't you? That was one of the things that allowed you to kind of move into feature films.
Yes, basically, well, the introduction of digital technology, which I made full use of, because not only it's, I think, aesthetically, I was also trying to do something new in terms of filmmaking style. So this is just like an introduction of my kind of aesthetics in my future films.
Mm. So it really does give a sense of where you were going to go, and people will get a chance to see some of the later films and the way that your style progresses.
Yes.
So that's great. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
So that's a one-off screening of The Masseur this Sunday, 23rd of October at 4:30 p.m. Now, for those of you that want to brush up on your digital skills, we have an Audio Boo workshop taking place next Thursday, 27th of October, at 6 p.m. Here's our digital content producer, Sarah Leach, to tell you a little bit more about it.
So Audioboo is a free platform on the internet. It's where you can host, record and share audio. We use the platform to host this podcast, actually. And in this session, you'll be getting loads of tips on how to record good quality audio and to share it with your friends, family and the rest of the world. So maybe if you're a freelance and you want to kind of promote the kind of work that you do, you work at a community radio station and you want to get some of your shows online, it's a great chance to pick up tips and skills on how to get your audio on the web. So tickets are £4 or £3 for concessions, and more details can be found if you head to the creative section of our website.
And moving away from Corner House, the Manchester Comedy Festival kicked off this week, running until the 30th of October, featuring over 240 shows in 30 venues right across Greater Manchester. Highlights include Tommy Tiernan at the Dance House, Hannah Chalmers' one-woman show Stripped at the Soup Kitchen, Adam Buxton's Bug making a welcome return to the Zion Arts Centre, and Chris Cox's non-mind-reading spectacular Fatal Distraction at the Lowry. For more information on everything going on, check out manchestercomedyfestival.co.uk.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Now, last week, one of our micro-commission projects put on a musical event with a difference. Kit Abramson's When Unlikely Things Happen was a balancing act of rhythm and showmanship, featuring 14 metronomes replicating the Amen Break, a six-second drum loop from 1969 that was instrumental in the creation of hip-hop, jungle and drum and bass. Our communications and program assistant, Ella Swain, caught up with Kit before her performance.
Kit, could you describe to me the setup that is in front of us in the annex?
Yeah, sure. Well, for the last 6 months, I've been working with Dub Section to set off a group of metronomes to play out the Amen Break. And in order to do this, we've been creating different devices, different apparatus, in order to get metronomes in sync with each other. In front of me, I can see some quite sculptural objects, really. Some floating devices, some swinging devices, and some rolling devices, each supporting the movement of metronomes to try and get them in phase with each other.
It kind of looks a bit like a mousetrap game setup. Does it work like that, or is it a bit more static?
No, it's not all static, and it does kind of have that feeling of consequences, where one thing happens and then you're kind of trying to anticipate what's going to happen next to try and get them to behave in the way that you want them to, in some sense sort of tame the metronomes into order. So I can understand how you think it looks a bit like the mousetrap.
It's a really interesting sounding project. Could you tell me a bit more about how you came up with the idea?
Yeah, it's really an idea born from the core of my practice, which is about mapping units from one system of understanding onto another. For the last couple of years, I've been really interested in the idea of time and how two very different senses of time can be brought into one piece. So this piece came about by thinking about time measured by clocks and calendars, and how time is measured by the body. So thinking about rhythm felt by the body, and then something that is structured and regulated, like the metronomes regulate traditional classical music, whereas a beat is felt by the body and is danceable. So those two different elements of time, really, within the work.
Just to explain it fully, you're attempting to play out the Amen Break using a series of metronomes, which is quite an ambitious idea. Why did you choose the Amen Break?
I think it's because it's very impossible. It's the hardest thing that we could have chosen to do. And I like to set myself impossible tasks and work with unpredictability. I think really what we're trying to achieve is potentially unachievable, and the idea of trying to do something, that attempt that potentially may or may not work, is what's interesting to me, that borders on success and failure, really. A sort of spirit of risk, and the process actually unfolding in front of an audience is a new avenue for me.
You were saying earlier that this is a sort of the launch of the project, and you talked quite a lot about the impossibility and the sense of kind of success or failure. Are you not nervous this evening?
I'm incredibly nervous because there's a lot to balance and juggle and fine-tune, and when you've got shaky hands, that can be very difficult. But I'm looking forward to how it's received, actually, because I think what we're trying to do is quite ridiculous, and it's quite funny, and I'm really interested to know whether the audience kind of get it in that way. You know, whether they will it to happen, will us to be able to play out the arm and break, or whether they think it's a success or a failure, and how they measure their experiences of the work is going to be quite fascinating.
I'm quite interested to know about the setup and the practicing process, really. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's taken 6 months to get to this point, and there's been an awful lot of listening to metronomes ticking, and also kind of really getting to know each individual metronome, because they've all got their own little personalities, and some of them are quite idiosyncratic, some of them don't behave. So there's a kind of collection of metronomes in my studio which are in the kind of naughty corner, because they refuse to do what we want them to do. It's been quite a journey, really, trying to find different ways in which we can get a group of metronomes to move. So we've had metronomes floating in the bath as a way of kind of getting it to this point where we can have a kind of flotation tank here. We've been swinging them on bits of cotton and kind of rolling them on Coke cans. And what you see here tonight is a kind of culmination of that kind of research, really. And the other side of it is really listening to the amen break over and over and over again, and trying to decipher that beat, really, and work out what's going on, because it's notoriously difficult to play on a drum kit. So even kind of attempting to do it out of something which you would normally associate with being regular is quite a feat.
It was fascinating. I didn't know quite what to make of it. I mean, I had no expectations coming in here. I knew there was going to be a load of metronomes. The stuff about the aim and break, I had no idea what that was all about. I don't know if that did actually happen or not, to be perfectly honest. That sense of expectation as you went and wound up all the metronomes, I thought was fascinating. And then when they all kind of started kicking off, and then the other noises came in, you know, the little bit of backing track, and then whatever she was doing on the doodah, whatever that was. You just sort of, like, flowed with it, really. And towards the end, I got this sense as all the metronomes started sort of cancelling out one by one. It was like life, you know, they all started together, and then suddenly there was just one left going. And that seemed to me the most sort of poignant bit, really.
Well, I thought it was very mesmeric and very evocative and very visually interesting because of the different settings and the movement of the metronomes, not just the side to side, but the movement of the metronomes within their frames. And I thought it was very evocative of whatever you wanted it to be. And for me, it was a bit scary in some ways. And it reminded me very much of ancient armies with infantrymen in, you know, Napoleonic-type outfits marching mindlessly into battle and, you know, the drums rolling them as they're marching in. But I think it could mean lots of things to lots of different people. And it certainly drew your mind in and captured your imagination.
I thought visually it was very impressive. I especially liked the different colours of the front metronomes and the fact they're all at different levels. I thought it looked very impressive. In terms of the sound, possibly not the best thing to listen to when you've got a massive hangover. But other than that, yeah, it was really, really good. It took a long time to get going, and then I think towards the end it kicked in and it was a bit clearer. The only slightly negative thing I can say about the sound was it was infuriating waiting for them all to stop, because obviously it was something you knew was going to happen and went on seemingly forever.
Well, I know this project from its development stage, but never fully understood it, and this is the very first time I've actually seen it all together. I've never seen anything like this, so I think as an art project it's extremely innovative in terms of, like, sensory perception, partly disturbing, partly hypnotic. Gives me something to think about.
It was the first time I've seen this piece, and I got really emotionally attached halfway through with the timing. It seemed to match my heartbeat at one point, and I got really, like, attached to them. I didn't want them to stop at the end because I find it interesting how they're all on different stands, and I want to know whether that changes the time, or I want to know more about it. Definitely, I play guitar myself and I've used metronomes before. I thought they were just for one use, and I didn't think they could be used in such a way to get emotionally attached someone to a piece of art. So it's intrigued me about whether the different metronomes used play a different part in it, or if they were all the same, would that make a difference?
That was Kit Abramson with her performance of When Unlikely Things Happen. If you have an innovative idea like Kit, which would cost less than £500 to bring to life, then visit our Micro Commission scheme website, microcommissions.org.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Cornerhouse, Manchester.
Now it's time for our staff recommendation of the week. Every week, one of the Cornerhouse team kindly put forward something that's caught their eye. This can be anything from a gig to a film to a random event they've discovered either here or outside of Cornerhouse. This week, our publications officer, Suzanne Davies, steps in with her suggestion.
I've just seen the proofs of Is Britain Great 3 and I'm really excited. We're actually publishing this one in association with the Caravan Gallery and it's looking really good. This is the third one that they've produced. The previous two ones have been really good sellers for us. The first one's already gone out of print and there's only a few left of the second one, so we're really hoping this is going to go down well. To give you some background, the Caravan Gallery was created in 2000 by two photographers. One's called Chris Teasdale and the other's Jan Williams. And they wanted a way of taking art to the people and they wanted to get people involved. And they also wanted to document the way that we live today and they wanted to create a visual archive of contemporary everyday life. I think it's so successful because everyone can really easily relate to the images that they produce and it's really, really funny. The photos seem to concentrate on the really grim. They take photos of areas that are in transition usually or in need of regeneration. And they often show spaces that sort of fall in between the urban and the suburban. But they really love these observations and they actually see it as a sort of celebration of contemporary life. They don't really make moral judgments and they're just not sneering at these people or the photos. It's just observations. When we take the book to book fairs, we always get people browsing this book. They can spend hours looking at it and laughing to themselves. So it's one that people really relate to. I think they used the caravan because it was a highly mobile venue where they could get people to come in and talk about the photos. A sort of, they call it a mini social club, really. And usually local people that do come in and laugh at the photos often give top tips to the photographers to say, go and look at this, you've not seen this, this is really good. And so they work on that and go and research that area and maybe take more photos. The photographers are also really interested in the stories behind them. So it's not only the aesthetic look of the photos, but it's how that's actually happened. And it opens the locals up to their own environment and often they're inspired to take a camera out themselves to see what they can spot. So the caravan's gone to many venues. It's already been to Corner House a long, long time ago, but it's also been outside of Tate Britain. It's been in supermarket car parks. It's been to Paul Smith in Tokyo. It's even been to rural Belgium. And they've realised that it works wherever they take it because it's just so accessible. Going on about the book, it's really nicely priced at £15 and it's coming out just before Christmas, so it's a really good stocking filler. This one includes some essays, one by the artists themselves about how they're going to take it further, and one by Sarah Jane Parsons of the Blue Coat Gallery in Liverpool, and also Dan Thompson of the Empty Shop Network. They're really little interesting insights. We're also really excited because we're hoping that Jan and Chris are going to come to Corner House's art night on November the 24th. They're going to bring the caravan and there'll be a chance then for people to just drop in and discuss the project. And also they'll be signing books. So if you wanted a signed copy to give as a present, that's a brilliant opportunity for you. So watch this space. Confirmations will come through on our website and on Twitter once everything's confirmed.
Thanks for that, Suzanne. And that just about wraps things up. For more information on everything we've talked about this week, do check out our website, cornerhouse.org. Alternatively, you can follow us on Twitter at cornerhousemcr or become a fan of our Facebook page. And don't forget, you can find all our archive podcasts on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Cornerhouse podcast.